Welcome to the Alternative Data Podcast. Welcome to the Alternative Data Podcast, powered by CFM. I'm Mark Fleming Williams. This is the first ever live recorded episode, which took place at New Data's Winter Summit in New York on December the 5th. For the panel, I was fortunate to share the stage with Matei Zatrianu of System 2, Tiad von Kapelle of AI Liftoff, Alexander Izidorczyk of CyberSyn, and Kelly Koszuska of Schulte, Roth & Zabel, as we embarked on an attempt to predict the future of alternative data in 5 years' time. In our conversation, we covered topics like innovation and datasets, the impact of LLMs, the new US administration's regulatory plans, consolidation in the space, the structure of hedge funds, and more.
Well, this is new. Episode number 130-something is going to be performed live in front of an audience. Off we go, I suppose. So I'm Mark Fleming Williams. I am the host of the Alternative Data Podcast and head of data sourcing at CFM. Delighted that I've got four extra special guests with me today. In fact, if anyone wants to know more about each of them, they have all had a podcast episode all to themselves as well. So you can get to know them better like that. But to introduce them, we've got Matei Zatrianu of System 2. Matei, there's a big European connection, I feel, at least in names here, because Matei shared a very interesting LinkedIn post recently about moving from Romania to the US in aged, what, 10, 11? Yeah, from Romania. So, System 2 is, what is System 2, Matei? You can say it better than me.
Yeah, so System 2 is a data science consultancy. My background is I worked at a hedge fund before this. It was like a $20 billion distress fund. I started a data team there and started System 2 about 9 years ago. The idea is that we are the data science team for a number of hedge funds, both on the long short equity side. We work with like two of the top 10 credit managers, work with like top pension funds as well, and it's either a supplement to their existing in-house data teams or it's an entirely different solution for that as well.
Perfect, thank you. And we've got Tiad von Kapelle, who is the latest arrival from Europe, arriving yesterday on a plane. And Tiad is the founder, formerly of NNIP, the Dutch pension fund, and the founder of AI Liftoff, which is an innovative alternative data provider. We've got, and I have set myself a challenge names-wise here. I mean, I haven't done myself any favors, but Alex Izidorczyk. Is that a Polish name, Alex?
Polish, yes.
Polish, yeah. They're always the most fun, those names. And when did your family come to America?
Early 80s.
Early 80s, okay. And Alex was the boy wonder head of data science at at Code2. And more recently has been created CyberSyn. Kelly Koszuska,
another... I'm not European, but we can try.
Another Polish name?
Presumably, yeah.
Presumably, but can't trace. So the oldest claim to having arrived in America.
Sorry, I'm not as exotic as the rest of
you. Oh, you're the most exotic, Kelly. No offense to the rest of you, but so Kelly is the alternative data lawyer extraordinaire, and I'm not sure your mic's working, FYI.
Can people hear me?
Yeah, that is working good. Brilliant. So the setup for this session is the future of alternative data. I've got a background pre this world of working in geopolitics, which is all about understanding things from a kind of developing trends perspective. So seeing the past, the present and the future and seeing where we are in that kind of overall schema. So the idea is that we should try and understand alternative data in context a little bit and where we are in the kind of development of it. So let's crack in. Alternative data is all about data sets, initially. So in terms of data sets, I mean, you could say alternative data began with credit card data. You could probably say it began with Venetian flags back in the 15th century. But how do you see novelty of data sets developing right now? And sorry, just one more contextual point. For the future, we're thinking, where will we be in 5 years' time? So shall I throw that to you, Matej? How are you seeing the development of innovation around alternative data sets?
I mean, we're seeing, it's two things. There is a bunch of innovation in the more traditional alternative data sets, whether it's your transaction data, email receipts, the location, all these things that have been around for a while. But we are seeing different ways of looking at that data. And it's, you know, it's, I was on listening to the panel earlier about the credit markets, and they were saying that this data has been properly tagged in equity markets, but with credit, some of those data sets don't have proper tags. And so there's opportunities to expand there. But there's so much, and it's honestly, it's the interesting thing to me is we've been able to squeeze so much out of price and volume data. Like, that's literally the entire backbone of quant investing. And there's tons of alpha to be had on just that one data set alone. Whereas with this, there's so many additional questions that we get asked from our clients to go like really deep into the data sets and figure things out. So that's one side of it. Another side of it, there are still plenty of new data sets coming to market. And in particular, what's happening is that there are cycles. To your point, from a historical perspective, there are certain things that come in and out of favor. So all of a sudden, you know, consumer was really hot during and after COVID. Now it's less of a thing. Everyone's talking about AI and data centers, like utilities, like a perfect example. Like, no one cared about utilities until AI made them cool again. And now everyone's talking about power plants and all these energy sources. So, and each one of those themes has data sets associated with them. So even though those data sets have been around for a while, they're fresh again because people are looking at them with new eyes.
I mean, with that though, there has been in the kind of 2010 to 2020 an explosion of novelty around data sets as people are like, wait a minute, I can sell this data to people. This data has value. And what you're describing potentially, because I would maybe say that in the last 4 or 5 years or 2 or 3 years, there's been less of that kind of novelty coming onto the market. But you're saying maybe that there's not that much novelty, but there are new use cases for the data which kind of emerged onto the scene, perhaps. But anyone else want to jump in on this? Yeah?
Yeah. So one of the things that I see is... as investors get more capacity to use data, that there's more interest in more granular data or more also coming into what you said, more topical data around certain themes, as well as more international data. For instance, we talk a lot about AI and LLMs, but take the Arabic language. LLMs or even Google Translate are terrible with that. So there's still a lot of opportunity to do more internationally what is already established in the US. So that's something I see as well. And then finally, as things progress, I also see something which you hear nothing about yet, is generated data. Mm. So that because as capacity grows, models will need more data to train, and then generated data might be something. So.
Is generated data as exciting as not generated data, or is it a fake?
The challenge is that it needs to have something extra, and we can do a separate podcast on that, I believe. Okay. So let's not go into that, but as something to keep in mind, watch it.
Yeah. Okay. Like we can get all the monkeys and all the typewriters just churning out data as much as possible. It'd be great. But Alex, have you got anything to add on it?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure if I agree with the premise that there's fewer novel alternative data. It's a little bit of hindsight bias. You know, I think in 2015, it wasn't clear that credit and debit card data would become so popular. These conferences were like the 10th the size. And so maybe people were saying, well, what's new in hedge fund research? You can, you know, there's more restrictions on, you know, expert networks. So what's really new, right? And only a few people really knew about credit card data or about certain other types of alternative data. So I think the novel types of alternative data coming out right now, you haven't heard about yet. And that's by design. So I think like in 5 years, we'll be like, okay, there's no new alternative data. If only we could go back to 2024, the good old days when there was all the new stuff. So I think there's like a 5-year like delay in when you show up the of the growth of alternative data, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Although I do think like the one thing that has probably changed is the core challenges in alternative data, or the core alpha generation mechanism, is, you know, not just discovering the existence of that data, but doing things with it. And I think Matei pointed out, you know, hey, you can cut and dice this data in a better way. And I think that's true. What's also true, and sort of a major difference between the haves and the have-nots, is the organizational components of, you know, which funds have properly set up data science teams and incentivized their data science teams, and then thought through what does the future of like a fundamental research analyst actually look like. Like, is this model of like, hey, you've got your data scientists and you've got your fundamental analyst, and those are different career tracks. And then eventually, if you're a fundamental analyst, you eventually become a portfolio manager or not. Is that actually the shape of fundamental, at least long short equity funds in the future, or do all these roles like change somehow? That's interesting too.
Alex, I don't know if you still believe it, but a long time ago you had a very nice 3-point list on whether a fund was serious about data or not in terms of from an organizational perspective. Do you still believe it? Can you say it now?
I have to be careful not to misquote myself.
But, no, I'm the only one who heard, so I won't tell anyone.
But in general, I think the broad point is, if you're serious about alternative data, first of all, you should be paying your head of alternative data in the same way that you pay your portfolio managers or your investors, right? So your data science team, your head of data, and, you know, as somebody who's worked as a head of data, maybe as some advocating for some future employer. But you
got the right audience. They're very happy about, they should be paid more.
Yes. But you should be paid to take risk. It shouldn't be a back office function. I think if you see it as, if it's a back office or support function, then maybe the firm isn't really that serious about it.
But how is the data team taking risk?
Well, I think the data team is taking risk the same way that a first year research analyst is taking risk.
Okay. Okay. And there was a budgetary aspect as well in your original, but anyway, let's.
I think the in general, if you kind of do the back of the envelope math, you can't be super serious to compete against the major large, you know, long short equity funds if you're not spending something like 15 to 20 million a year on your data effort. I would say that's like my back of the envelope math. And by the way, this makes launching new funds very hard, because that 15 to 20 million, whether you do well or do poorly, you have to pay every year. That's coming out of your, you know, management fee. So then when you work backwards, think of how big of a launch you have in order to afford a data science team that can compete with, you know, best in class.
Mm-hmm. Kelly, I'm throwing you a curveball, but would you say, if we're continuing the analogy of in order to be seen as serious about data, you would need X, is there a kind of compliance, like you would need a certain level of clients' compliance of its sophistication around data, perhaps?
I'm not going to say you should pay your lawyers more to show that you're serious about compliance.
You're taking risk in a way, aren't you?
I know who the audience is. They want Alex, not me. To be able to take compliance seriously and data seriously, you have to understand this world. So you're not, if you're a registered investment advisor in the US, you're not getting on the wrong side of the regulator. I think people understand that now in a way they didn't several years ago. And that's in part because of the enforcement action against App Annie and just the space getting more sophisticated on this. We have struggled to bring efficiency and standardization to the compliance function. The data is getting much more complicated. It is material in a way that was more theoretical a few years ago, both because public companies are increasingly monetizing their data, so we're worried about material non-public information, and you can just get so much more information from consumers and other sources. So that piece is getting harder. And this compliance MMPI function, which is very different from privacy, is so niche to our industry. With the data changing so rapidly, it's very hard to standardize that. What I hope is that AI brings that solution, that all the work we're doing now that's still very labor intensive, that eventually some LLM will be training on it and we'll get to a better place on that.
Is the compliance risk growing?
I think it is.
I have just one thought on this, and a lot of it comes down to incentives. And I totally agree with you, Alex, saying that if your data team is seen as a back office, it's not going to produce the same kind of results as if they're seen as front office. And I think there are ways to do this, even from your perspective as a lawyer. If you're an in-house lawyer somewhere, you're a cost center to that organization. The reason why you're here on this stage, among others, is that you have to go out there and hunt and bring in new revenue. And that incentive difference makes it so that you have to fight a little bit harder for what you're doing, and you have to be better. You can't just stay complacent and do the same job you did last year and expect to get paid a little bit more. And we do this with when we hire people as well. Like, we don't have the budgets of a big hedge fund, but we do, and I tell this whenever I'm on a career fair somewhere, is that you want to be as close to revenue generating as possible in whatever organization you're in. And the roles can be different, right? You can have, like, in what we've done is we've taken a bunch of, like, nerdy data scientists that would have been seen as back office and made them revenue generating in our company. And now you have the culture is better. You have all these additional incentives. But I think it's the same in a bunch of other industries. And, like, thinking through the incentives that you're creating for your team is going to produce, like, massive results in how that team performs.
I mean, continuing the analogy of taking data seriously, but presumably the reason why data is kind of secondary is that you can have a hedge fund without data people, but you can't have the data people without the investment guys. So in a way, although Matteo, you're kind of the closest thing that's possible in a way. You're just the data guys, you know. But it is secondary, is it almost by definition? Wouldn't you say?
I don't think so. I think that's like saying, you know, you could have a hedge fund with investment people who do no research. I mean, that doesn't work. Or you can have a quant fund with no data. So I don't think so. I think data is just another form of research. And to have a hedge fund, you have to do research.
So in my previous job, I did have a team of data scientists and PMs, and they were just equally paid. So fixed pay as well as variable pay. Mm. So it was equal effort in terms of risk and return. So it is possible.
Sounds nice. Okay, so let's shift gears a bit. Changes. So again, we're casting forward 5 years. LLMs arrived in a big way. How are LLMs going to shape the market, the way we work? How in 5 years' time are we going to look back and say, you know, this was the time, the kind of pre-digital, those analog years in 2024. How will the world have changed? Tiered?
To predict exactly how the world has changed, that's a difficult one.
You've got to take risk, Tiered.
Yeah, I know. But I see much use also in how we let different LLMs work together. Eh? So, people know ChatGPT, of course, but we at Airlift have worked with very different LLMs with very specific tasks. And so we already use 12 different LLMs to get our data, but I think that will be only more and more. And like I said, there are so many specific tasks for which you can use them, but also in integrating them with other types of AI. Mm-hmm. So that's what I will see. And yeah, things like, I don't know whether people still do that, writing reports, but that is something that I think will be done. And like, if your fund performs bad, it's easy to write a story to blame the market and so on. And if you do, you are the talented manager. So why not let an LLM do that?
Does anyone have any comments on the way LLMs and their ubiquity might change data providers and the way data providers have to work? And maybe, I'm not against making this a podcast episode about company structure. So we could do that as well, the way it changes the structure of a fund as well.
Well, I think on the LLM question, I think one of the really interesting things, at least from a hedge fund research perspective or data science perspective with LLMs, is if you think of these things as big trends and changes in the way we do research, alternative data was this sort of big wave that the world found out about gradually, right? So there was funds that were doing alternative data in 2013, and then there's more funds doing it in 2018, and today everybody's doing it. And the wave was kind of this like slow wave that grew, right? With LLMs, it's a little bit different because with LLMs, there is no advantage to doing it first because, like, you know, everybody knows about ChatGPT, right? So there's no surprise. No, you know, I don't think there's any hedge fund in the world that thinks, oh, AI won't make any difference, right? So it's a very different kind of wave. It kind of comes at you vertically where everybody gets it at once. And so then the alpha generation has to be in how you use it because everybody gets the same tools. Everybody gets, you know, the same access. It costs the same. So what do you do? And I think the two categories of LLM use that I think are relevant, and I think only one of them gets a lot of press. So the first category that gets a lot of press is the UI or UX layer, right? This is what you see with ChatGPT. So this is writing reports, querying your data, you know, summarizing kind of what's in front of you, right? And I would put this into like a productivity tool, right? It's almost like, you know, whatever you were doing, you can now do it better because you can read 10 times as much content. So this is like the UI, UX layer productivity tool. And then the second thing that I think just gets slightly less attention is, you know, the data structuring that can and data cleaning that LLMs can do. So I think that for some types of alternative data, it'll just be easier to clean that data to put it into a usable form. For other types of alternative data, it'll be like, there was no structured form of this alternative data, and we created a structured form of this alternative data with the LLM. And so it creates new data sets, not synthetic hallucinated data sets, just data sets that were completely unstructured and random that you could never sort of convert them into some sort of tabular consistent form. Like even if you think about the like age-old, you know, like sentiment classification, right? It used to be that you buy news articles, you like run some algorithm, or somebody like Ravenpack runs the algorithm for you and gives you kind of like a sentiment score, positive or negative. But now you can build in so much granularity with those LLMs where you could be like, well, I want a signal for how concerned about inflation the speaker is, or I want a signal for you know, the conviction with which the person spoke. And you could just arbitrarily come up with like more ideas on any type of unstructured data of any type, right? You could have photos of stores and say, well, how disheveled does this store look? And so I think it, you know, there's this, the first UI productivity piece with LLMs is obvious. I think the other one that's a little bit less loved and probably more here and now that you could actually do this in your fund today is this kind of like data structuring piece. Because the UI UX piece, I don't think we've really figured out. Everyone's building ChatGPT clones and it's cool, it makes good demos, but I don't think it's in production yet.
Yeah, like one point I would add to that is the business model perspective of LLMs, which is a side note, I think is one of the cool things about our jobs because we're a bunch of tech nerds, but at the same time, we work in finance, which forces us to function, to focus a little bit more on the business applications of this. And what I think is interesting is, again, it's, we're not questioning the usage of LLMs or its popularity. What I want to draw attention to is like the second order question, which is, let's think about it from a business perspective. And to illustrate that, there's a phenomenal quote from Warren Buffett when, after he first invested in Berkshire Hathaway, and an employee there came up to him and said, there's this new machine that's going to double our productivity. It's amazing. Things are going to be awesome. And Warren replies, gee, I hope it doesn't work, because if it does, I'm going to have to sell the company. And what he meant by that was, everyone can get excited about increases in productivity, but no one stops to think about, where are those advantages going to accrue to? Are you as the company going to benefit from that increased productivity, or do you have to pass it off as lower prices to your customers? And what can happen in these very competitive industries with no moat is like, yeah, sure, my factory can buy this equipment, but so can every other factory. And now we have massive CapEx to purchase these new pieces of equipment. And then our prices are going to go down because everyone else is lowering their prices because they've got more efficient. And I think something similar is happening in the AI space, where everyone is investing a ton of money. We clearly see it from like the NVIDIA like revenues, is investing a ton into AI without necessarily thinking about, is my advantage, is this cool like demo that I just built going to be sustainable? And, you know, not to like dunk on any of the things that we've seen even today, which I think are awesome. But okay, I'll give an example that's not from this industry. I saw for Black Friday, I got an ad for Blinkist, Blinkist, if you guys don't know, it's like this this app has been around for a while that summarizes books. So if you like to read, you can read these short summaries. And it was like 90% off. It was like instead of $100 for the year, it was like $7. And I was like, why would they be doing this? They're talking about all their new AI features and this and that. And then I tried something. I went on my computer and I went to ChatGPT, the book that I'm reading right now, and I'm like, hey, summarize this book for me. And it did. Like, it actually had that access to the corpus of that book. And I was like, yeah, no shit. These guys are, like, discounting so much because, like, their product has just been replaced by ChatGPT. So I think this is going to be, like, whether we're looking at, like, you know, company filings or this or that, the question is going to be, yeah, this stuff is great, but can I just do it with my $20 a month subscription to ChatGPT, or do I need to subscribe to some fancy product that took a lot of money and effort to build?
But I think that's where our industry is going to have an advantage. And one of the things when we talk to consultants that they're seeing and that they're concerned about at companies is that the AI technology is way outpacing the governance. For regulated entities like hedge funds and private equity funds, we can't afford that. Compliance always has to be there day one. We've learned the hard way from alt data, from electronic communications. It may make it go a little more slowly, but you're not seeing that the technology has way outpaced the governance. They're going hand in hand. And I also think with venture investing in some of these companies, they should be, the good investors are asking the hard questions because they know the difference between a shiny object and who's really going behind the, this looks cool, this actually offers value.
Matei.
By the way, just on the legal point, can you imagine the subpoena powers that legal agencies are going to have with LLMs? And electronic communications or documents, right? All of a sudden, it's not, you know, producing 10,000 documents that somebody has to sift through, but it's much quicker to search. So I do think that compliance in some ways will become more important as the regulators start using these technologies more.
And they have actually been using big data for a long time. That's why, not AI, but that's why the SEC does insider trading so well. What will change in the short term and will be hard for all of us is now that everything is going to be transcribed and all these meetings that used to go away when you ended the Zoom or click the phone, when we have written records of all that, that's going to be a treasure trove for regulators.
Matei, yeah, I've now got to tick the box, which is saying this podcast episode contains swearing. And I think the last time I had to do that was when you were on it as well. What was that, Kelly?
I said, I'm excited to learn we can curse on the podcast.
Well, yeah, I think we lose all our child listeners, unfortunately. But
I was just going to say, I have young kids at home, so this is a joy for me to be able to be myself for a change.
Free. So... Kelly, we've got a new US government. We've got a 4-year period ahead. What does that mean for regulation, do you think, of alternative data?
Nobody knows. So for us, the primary regulator is the SEC when we're talking about private funds, though FTC with alternative data should play a bigger role. Surprisingly, even though this current administration was hyper-focused on regulation, they were so focused on so many things that alt data was no longer a priority. And that was at a time when, for the reasons I discussed earlier, alternative data is getting much more complex. I don't know what to expect, especially because with DOGE, we don't know what recommendations they'll make or what impact that will have on the SEC. We definitely expect an SEC that's less focused on actual regulation, but that sometimes frees up the examiners to go deeper on issues. The alt data exams that were basically the blueprint for the compliance programs we now do, that was under the Trump administration. It had nothing to do with Trump. It had nothing to do with his head of the SEC. It's just you had people with time on their hands realizing that private funds are spending a lot of time and money on this. So I would expect that we actually might see a deeper dive because it's just an interesting place where people should spend time.
I think the other thing that's super interesting in terms of data regulation that probably affects hedge funds not so much, but affects data vendors that I've been paying attention to is, you know, traditionally it's been like the SEC, the FTC, right? So MNPI, privacy. And what's super fascinating that I've been following is, as many of you know, some of the most interesting data businesses are these give-to-get data cooperatives, right? And unfortunately, some of these cooperatives have apparently gone so far as to, you know, effectively allow competitors to exchange each other's information for the purpose of increasing prices. And so you've seen DOJ cases brought against certain data providers on a theory of antitrust, of algorithmic collusion. And I don't think any of this is settled yet, but there's a case against Yardi, which is a property management software that advertises a data product that helps you increase rent based on your neighboring landlord's rent. So you're basically, you know, colluding on the price algorithmically. And then there's another company called AgriStats, which is sort of a similar concept for commodity prices. And so when you look at a company like AgriStats and you compare that to, say, Nielsen IQ and Circana, where retailers are exchanging information to make better price decisions, is there a difference? Now, obviously, this is all alleged. It's unclear if this theory will stick. But this is kind of like a third prong that I personally find very fascinating. Again, I don't think this is really a private funds issue. It's more of a data vendor issue.
Yeah, I don't think it's a hedge fund issue because it wouldn't impact the materiality analysis. It potentially could indirectly be a private equity issue because of portfolio companies. If you're getting data to help your portfolio companies analyze it, then you would care about anything that could be deemed anti-competitive.
Consolidation in the industry. We're looking 5 years ahead. What do the providers look like in 5 years' time? Are they going to be forming up, grouping up into one big or five big oligarchic providers? Does it suit everyone for it to be splintered? How does that look consolidation-wise in 5 years' time? Consolidation of buy side probably not so much. I don't know. Any thoughts on consolidation?
Yeah, actually, why not the consolidation on the buy side? I think that is very much in play because you already mentioned the skill that's necessary, yeah, if you want to have a serious data operation. Now, if it comes to the data providers, it's very low entry, right? It's very easy to enter. So I think new vendors will come up. But there might be some vertical integration. To get the whole data sourcing within one thing. That's something I foresee.
Yeah, but by the way, I think buy-side consolidation is the biggest kind of secular trend in active management. Like, we're right now at sort of what I would call peak pod, that is the multi-strategy managers, the Citadels, the Balyasnys, the Schoenfelds, the Millenniums, right, are growing. And they're, you know, both expanding internally the number of portfolio managers they support, but also making, sole GP investments in other funds. And so even though you have got these other businesses that look like separate funds, they're really just an extension of Millennium or Bally or whatever. And it makes sense because they can centralize costs. And as compliance costs rise, they also benefit from, that scale. And the more scrutiny there is, the fewer funds kind of can afford it. At the same time, you've still got competition from passive funds or low-cost replicating funds, smart beta products that are very cheap that can replicate a lot of hedge fund strategies. So I think the days of sort of setting up a hedge fund with like three people in a room in Excel are sort of over. And you have to think really, really hard what the advantage is. And then on top of that, a lot of the flagship LPs, right? So think the pension funds. I mean, Canada's pension funds, for instance, are really good at this and well known at this. They set up direct investment groups. So, take CPPIB, for example, they're doing a lot of direct investment. They're essentially running a multi-pod shop internally because, why pay the fees? And so I think that if anything, the hedge fund world will consolidate. And the only way to buck that trend, if you want to start your own hedge fund, is to come up with something that is, for whatever reason, structurally difficult for these large managers to complete. I agree. On the data vendor point, I mean, I think Bloomberg and S&P or FactSet and some of the other large data vendors will keep buying companies. We saw that with Visible Alpha. And then I think that there's some advantages to being a small, nimble startup where you can do things very quickly with a new idea to bring something new to market.
we definitely have seen the rise in popularity of the multi-strats, and we work with a lot of them. But I'm not quite as bleak on the competition. We do see managers that are small not leaning into alt data, not because they don't do a lot of research, but they're just differentiating themselves in a different way. And Mark, it was actually on one of your podcasts when I was on with the SEC that I pushed the SEC on this point and said, if you make compliance so hard and so expensive, you're going to price out some of these smaller players. And it was on that podcast that they started embracing standardization, as that would be the normalizer. And I think with AI, some of these things create a lower barrier to entry. So I do think, I agree with the trends we're seeing, but I do think there is space for the smaller players.
Yeah, and by the way, I think that's a huge opportunity with AI. Could you replicate what Citadel does with AI, right? Imagine you could snap your fingers and sort of have a first year, you know, financial analyst Citadel employee. It's like, okay, now suddenly the cost structure changes and being big doesn't change anything. As long as this regulatory capture pulling the ladder up behind yourself issue doesn't occur.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I was actually talking about that on a previous panel where every new technology creates opportunities for the underdogs to be able to compete with the establishment. And if you, instead of hiring a bunch of pod PMs, you have a bunch of AI agents that are all competing with each other, and then you sit on top of that to create some superstructure, it could be interesting. And but I think like for a bunch of the data providers in this room, like I'm going to go out on a limb and predict that we're going to see a ton of transactions, like M&A activity in the next 5 years. And for the simple reason that just even from my on the System 2 side, for the first time ever, people give a shit about us. Like we're getting calls from private equity firms, and I have a call, hopefully this airs after that, with a guy who is former like Google executive who's now part of a search fund where he's got money from some private equity backers and he wants to buy one company and run it. And my take on this whole thing, and I know I've spoken to a bunch of founders in the alt data world over the years, a lot of people have been doing this for a while. They want to move on. They want to do something else. And if you are at like a hype cycle where the valuations for basically slap AI and data on your company and then convince a bunch of unsophisticated PEs that want to go in on this theme, and you get a crazy multiple on your business, like, yeah, who wouldn't take that trade, especially within this alt data space that has historically not seen a ton of activity. So I would imagine that, yeah, there will be some beneficiaries of this AI hype cycle.
Is that consolidation? Would they end up being pushed together by the PEs, do you think, and turned into a massive company? Or is this a way of keeping them small, maybe?
The best part is that's their problem. And this is not like, I'm not saying this is going to be good or bad for the industry, but someone else wants to take on that risk and we're just flipping it. And be like, oh yeah, you figure out how to make money out of all of this. And as we know, it's hard, right? Like it's hard to, like, we're here trying to sell our businesses and we come every year and it's not an easy thing. But if, yeah, the P is like, oh yeah, multiples are great. AI is going to make everything so much better. Yeah, you figure out how to make money off it.
Somebody buy Mate's business, please.
System 2 AI, you got to call it.
Oh, yeah, we have the domain. So yeah.
System 3.
pricing, future pricing, is it getting more expensive? Will it be more expensive, cheaper in 5 years, data? Or the same?
I bet the same.
Can we see a direction of travel in the last 5 years? That's a good way of thinking about the next 5 years sometimes.
Just alternative data set pricing.
Yeah.
Like what we're seeing, so we're in a pretty cool position because we work with a number of funds and we control a bunch of budget across the entire client base. And one of the main themes is, first of all, standardization. It used to be like the Wild West where every provider would come up with like whatever, stick a finger up in the air, be like, that's how much I'm going to charge for this client. And as word is getting around, more people are talking to each other, there's some standardization there. So that's, I think, theme number one. Theme number two is more flexibility, where you now have more edge cases. And again, this is partly because the market's been somewhat saturated, at least within the investment vertical. We now see data providers willing to do custom things. Like if it's an emerging manager, like some person who just left a fund to start their own thing and they don't have the budget yet, they're hoping to raise money. Like, yeah, maybe we'll get some transaction data for like really cheap for the first like 6 months so he can continue to build up his track record so he can then get, hopefully get more investment and then pay the larger fees. So we're definitely seeing standardization. We're seeing flexibility, and in some cases, we're seeing more competition, which is reducing prices. I think it's like that segment modularity that has been most interesting to us because especially going into private equity, they have very different budgets, different ways of thinking about data spend, and so having that kind of flexibility has been really helpful there.
Yeah, to add to that, I think indeed one of the things to get a premium as a provider is to do more bespoke things. So that's a trend that I see continuing.
Yeah, at a lot of funds, this is a fund expense. So they are thinking about, do these data sets deliver something? And it's why we continue to see, even though on the investment side, the analysts, non-data scientists are getting better with data. When you have a separate data team whose only job is to vet the data, decide if it still gives value, because they're not focused on how does this tie into this one investment, it does seem to have nice synergies. And you see less of this, let's just get every data set under the sun and which are the ones that are really worth the money and worth continuing.
Yeah, I do think there is more competition for stuff that's been around for a while, right? Like there's more credit card data vendors today than there were 5 years ago. I would bet there's going to be more credit card data vendors in 5 years than today. So I think some of this stuff, there's some pressure, but then obviously other things fill the void because there's new data sets or there's new technologies you sort of have to spend on. Maybe there's some cleaning out of data sets that people had high hopes for and didn't work. So I don't think the cost materially changes. And I think likely as people figure out how to build more and more complex research systems, this you know, 15 to 20 million to be competitive likely slowly crawls up, modulo these drop downs that once in a while come from technology.
And to your previous point, I know you love to hate on the Circanas and MPDs out there, but that's another way to keep prices high is to just have a monopoly and people have to buy from you.
I don't hate them. They're wonderful businesses.
We've got to stop there. Unclear whether Alex hates them or not. That's it. That's the end. That's a wrap. Thank you very much, everyone, for taking part in the first ever Alternative Data Podcast Live. It's been a great pleasure. I realized halfway through that Mate and Alex are the two American male voices, and so hopefully everyone can tell the difference on the podcast, but I should have said your names more.
I'm actually Canadian.
You're Canadian? Oh, there we go. Well, then if you'd said more hoos and things like that, then it would have been clear.
Out and about.
But no, so thank you very much to the panel, and yeah, thank you to the live audience, and yeah, we'll see you afterwards.